Srimad Bhagavatam for us is the primary source of spiritual knowledge. Nigama kalpa taroa galitam palam. Shukamakad amita dravya samyutam. Tibeta bhagavatam rasamalayam mahuraho rasikab ubi bhavukaha. Especially those who have a higher taste for spiritual knowledge, for the essence of spiritual knowledge, they should focus their attention on studying Srimad Bhagavatam. There are so many people with practical material intelligence who can study so many sciences, but what we lack in this world is persons with a more refined intelligence who can become experts in the science of transcendence as taught in Srimad Bhagavatam, especially for Kali Yuga. Even among all the Vedic literatures, Srimad Bhagavatam is the most relevant, practical source of all kinds of knowledge. It's the Paramahamsa Samhita. So it's first of all meant for those who have given up all interest in material things and simply want to dedicate themselves fully to the service of the Supreme Person. But they really want to dedicate themselves fully to the service of the Supreme Person. Fully to the service of the Supreme Person. But there are many other practical things that are that light is shed upon in the Bhagavatam. There is discussion of how the Varnashram social system is established, how it's organized. Some systematic discussion, briefly, in the 7th canto, 12th through 15th chapters, Narada Muni gives his instructions to Yudhishthira Maharaj on the topic of Varnashram. But it's very brief, basic outline. You'll find much more detailed information in books like the Manasamhita. But beside that short systematic presentation by Narada Muni in the 7th canto, we have graphic illustrations of how the social system works through the personal histories of various devotees. So this is one example that we picked for the topic of this course, this dialogue between Kardama and Manu. Kardama haven't met yet. Kardama is offering his prayers. Lord Vishnu has come to him, and Lord Vishnu is going to respond. And then after that, Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, is going to arrive on the scene. So Srimad Bhagavatam, anything we need to know we can find in Srimad Bhagavatam. If we become convinced of that, then we can take advantage of this book. Just tell your chairs, okay. This book can change the world. This particular book has the potency to overturn the confused condition of human society, to affect a spiritual revolution. Unfortunately, we're not fully convinced of that. We think we have to go to other sources of knowledge and go back, you know, to our Western civilization and pick the brains of people who have no spiritual potency. But Bhagavatam is not isolated. It's not something that just popped out of Vyasadeva's head from nowhere. Nigama kalpa taror galigam palam. The Srimad Bhagavatam, it's not just a metaphor. This is a description of the actual relationship of Bhagavatam to the Vedic literature. Nigama kalpa taru. We were discussing yesterday about desire tree and desire cow. So the Vedas, yesterday the metaphor was being applied to the Supreme Lord, is the source of all desires. He's the original desire tree, the personality of Godhead. And then, sarcastically, sardonically, Kardama was expressing his own need to have a wife who will be the desire tree for his family life. Here, in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, in this verse, Nigama Kalpa Toror, third verse of the first chapter of the first canto, Suta Goswami, it's actually Vyasadeva speaking there, is saying that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedas, which are a desire tree. So Bhavadhana has a very essential, integral connection, relationship with the entire corpus of the Vedic literature, with the original Vedas. And the Vedas are said to be a tree, a mystical desire tree. And the desire tree has the quality that although people have all different kinds of desires, there are different individuals with different kinds of conditioning, the Vedas can easily fulfill the desires of anybody. It's got something for everyone. But the other significance of that metaphor of the tree, a tree is a single living entity, an organic unity. When you have a living being as opposed to just a random combination of inert matter, there is integral relationship between the parts. The roots of the tree, the leaves, the bark, the veins that carry the sap, they're all parts of one total organism which works together as a whole. All parts serve the whole, and there's a living intelligence holding it all together, controlling the whole, the entire whole. That's what a living organism means. If the presiding intelligence leaves, if there's death, then the organism very quickly disintegrates. So the Vedas are a single organic whole. There's one intelligence tying together all the Vedic literatures. It's not the way that modern scholars, Western scholars, see it, or even Indian scholars nowadays. They see that all these Vedas were written, you know, a couple of thousand years ago by some nomads that came from Siberia. And then after that, hundreds, a thousand years after that, you know, the Brahmins gained their predominance over the other classes, and they wrote these other books, Puranas and other books, in order to keep the other classes subjugated and keep them in superstition. And then, you know, other books were written later on. Different times, different people wrote different books, and they all had different purposes. Different authors, different purposes, different consciousness. But that's against what the Bhagavatam is saying. You can take your pick. You can follow Max Miller and the other Westerners, or you can follow the explanation of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's your choice. The Bhagavatam says the Vedas are a single organic whole. There is one intelligence behind all the Vedic literature. And it's just different books. Just like a desire tree has to satisfy everybody. It's got to be able to produce anything as a fruit. You know, if someone wants an automobile, it's got to be able to produce an automobile. Someone else wants a house, the tree has to produce a house. So the Vedas have to be ready to provide anything to anyone. So there are different parts of the Vedas, just like different parts of a living organism, different limbs. There are different books, but they're all coming from the same intelligence. They're just addressing different audiences, and therefore they seem to be talking about different things. But it really, there's one purpose, one living organism is always working for one goal, to live its life. It needs water so it reaches down into the ground. It needs air so the leaves reach up. It needs light and air so the leaves reach up. But that those opposite tendencies are really one urge just to maintain the life, to grow and live. Like that, the Vedas are serving its unified purpose in various ways because there are various kinds of people that are approaching the Vedas, different audiences. Okay, and then within that organic whole of all the different Vedic texts, the Bhagavatam is being presented as, in this verse, Galitam Phalam. The tree's got its roots, it's got its bark, it's got its various parts. But what's the glory of the tree? What's the real purpose of its existence? It's the fruit. You know, the flowers come, the leaves come, the flowers come out of the leaves, and out of the flowers grow the fruits. And that fruit, that sweet fruit, that is the ultimate value of the tree. So in the hierarchy of values, a tree that bears fruit, edible fruit, is the most valuable and worshipable tree. If a tree can't produce fruit, if it can provide shade, okay, it's a second-class tree. And if a tree cannot provide fruit or shade, then it's third-class. And if a tree just has thorns and is just a trouble source of botheration, then it's fourth-class. So the fruit is the most valuable product of the tree, or part of the tree. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedic desire tree. It's intricately connected to the original Vedas and all the other Vedic literatures, and it's the most valuable part. The essence, the distilled essence of all the Vedic knowledge is put into Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, that's the Bhagavatam itself saying that. If you don't trust the Bhagavatam, you can dismiss it. But we are devotees of Srimad Bhagavatam if we're followers of Caitanya Mahaprabhu. So we'll accept that statement, I think. So, in doing research for this class, I was looking for some statements from Shastra that explain, especially, the relationship between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. So the Bhagavatam says many things. We can look in other Puranas and find some interesting things. But a prime source of very interesting statements about the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, their different positions, and especially their interaction, how the Brahmins and Kshatriyas work together, is found if we go all the way back to the Vedas. And so I dug up some quotations. We'll be looking at them over the next few days. I did not yet hand out. I have prepared printouts of these quotations and the translations, so you don't have to worry about writing them down as I say them. But I'm not going to hand them out immediately. Yeah. First, I'll introduce the statements in class. And then afterwards, I'll hand out the sheets. Yeah, but you'll get them all. I wanted to discuss, if anybody's not familiar with how the Vedas are organized, what the different kind of books are from the original Vedas. I just wanted to go over a brief outline of the Vedic Shastras, going back to the original Vedas. And especially, these are the books in which we find relevant statements about the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas and how they work together. So, okay, I don't know if this is readable all the way to the back. The original Vedas are called Shruti, as opposed to more recent books. The original Vedas are eternal. They were not written by anybody. I think we discussed that already. How not even God should be considered the author of the Vedas, because they never were written. They always existed. Therefore, they're called Shruti. They're just what's received through the simple succession by hearing. So Shruti means hearing. So they have a special authority. The Puranas and other more recent books, they're in a different category. They're called Smriti. Shruti has to be passed down from generation to generation without any change. Not even one syllable should ever be changed. And not only syllables, but in the original Vedas, the words have different intonations. A high, low, middle, like musical sounds. And they have to be preserved, exactly. Otherwise, the text is corrupted. There's the example of Tvashta was sacrificing to get someone who would be an opponent of Indra, and because he wanted to get someone out of the fire sacrifice who could defeat Indra, but he chanted one syllable with the wrong intonation. One syllable was wrong, not even pronounced wrong, but he just made it with the wrong musical tone. And because the word was changed, instead of getting a hero, he got a demon, Vritrasura. Because Vritrasura was killed by Indra instead of killing Indra. So this is the Vedas have to be preserved without changing. But they're considered the most basic authoritative source of all knowledge. If we can quote something from the Vedas that substantiates what we want to say, then it's really authoritative. Now, the Bhagavatam is our first authority, but the Bhagavatam itself goes back to the Vedic sources in many ways. Many things that are said in the Bhagavatam are echoes of what's stated in the Vedas. It's like in the second canto. The whole second canto practically is a commentary on the Vedas. Especially chapter 6, Purusha Sutta confirmed. Those chapters 5, 6, and 7, spoken by Brahma, are practically a verse-by-verse commentary on the Purusha Sutta. In many other ways, the Bhagavatam is echoing things that were said previously in the Vedas and Upanishads. So, anyway, even the Vedas, although the Vedas are not textbooks, you know, topical textbooks for high school or for university. In the Vedas, there's lots of information about everything, but it's not presented systematically. It's not organized, you know, for classroom use. So if we want to find information about the social system, Varnashram, in the Vedas, we can find plenty, but it'll be scattered around, not arranged systematically. And there is. Some people who have studied the Vedas superficially, mundane scholars, say that there's no concept of the Varnashram system in the Vedas. You know, even there's no real clear concept of what a Brahmin is, what a Kshatriya is, of those divisions of society. That's not true. If you actually study the Vedas in depth, you'll find a lot of very explicit statements about the social order. But you have to look around. You won't find a chapter heading. Here's all the information about Varnashram in one place. So in the Vedas, in the different sections of the Vedas, there is very interesting information about the social system. And then there are later books connected to the Vedas, which are specifically on the topic of social organization. So here, I just want to explain. Of course, there are originally four Vedas. Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. They're all composed of spiritual sound. But there's different kinds of sound. Just like ordinary language has different kinds of use. I can sit here and give a scientific explanation of something. Or else I can sit here and recite some poetry. Or we could be sitting in a court, and I could be the judge sentencing you to 40 years in jail. So those are different uses of language. If I'm just making a philosophical or scientific explanation, the language I use is not going to be the same if I was reciting a poem. So, similarly, the four kinds of Vedas are each speaking a different kind of language. That's really the basis of the division of the four Vedas. The Rig Veda, the Vedas are used in performing sacrifice. We can understand these different kinds of language by seeing how the different functions that these four Vedas play in the sacrifice. In a Vedic sacrifice, in a big Vedic sacrifice, not a small sacrifice you perform yourself at home, but an elaborate soma sacrifice, where you're supposed to have 16 or 17 priests, four priests from each Veda, and then an extra priest. They perform very specific separate roles. The Rig Veda priests are like the butler or the master of ceremonies. Like if you have an aristocratic get-together in your home and many important people are coming, then the butler will announce the guests as they arrive. Like that, the Rig Veda priests, the sacrifice is like a reception or a feast for the demigods. So the demigods are invited to attend, and as they come, their arrival is announced by the Rig Veda priest. The Rig Veda priests chant various hymns in glorification of the demigods. They're inviting them, come to the sacrifice. And they're announcing, here is Indra. He's the great slayer of Vikrasura. And he's, you know, here's his thunderbolt, his weapon. He has so many glories. Like the butler announcing, here's Lord so-and-so and his wife. So, certain kind of prayers, the language of glorification, is recited in the Rig Veda. It serves its purpose, particular purpose in the sacrifice. But another important function is performed by the Yajurveda priests. In the sacrifice, you have to take ordinary items and transform them into something mystical. Just like this in the Yajurveda, and the Yajurveda mantras serve that purpose. And the priests of the Yajurveda, those who chant these mantras, are like magicians or sorcerers, who can change, you know, pull a rabbit out of a hat and perform various magic tricks. So the Yajurveda priest, he recites a mantra, like for example, it's an ordinary clay pot, like you can buy for 15 rupees. Done, you know, made by a potter, ordinary shudra, you know, a person who's not even allowed to sit, you know, in the arena at the sacrifice. So you take the pot he made, and the Yajurveda priest takes the pot and he says, you are the womb of Aditi. You are the womb of the earth.
And so by chanting that mantra, he's transforming an ordinary clay pot into a magical element of the paraphernalia of the sacrifice. That pot is going to be used to hold the milk that is going to be offered to Soma in the evening in the Agnihotra sacrifice. So you have to transform the ordinary pot into a sacrificial pot by chanting that mantra. The Yajurveda priest, the magician, sorcerer, transforms the material things into sacrificial paraphernalia. He creates the physical sacrifice by his mantras. That's like the judge in the court. The kind of language where you say something and it creates the reality. You know, I declare you man and wife. By the judge saying that, or I sentence you to hang until you're dead. By saying that, the judge creates a reality. He has the power to do that. That's a special kind of language. That's the kind of language that you find in the Yajurveda. The magical language that creates a special reality. Then the Samaveda language, okay, your guests come to the festival, you have to entertain them. So you hire an orchestra, they play music during the banquet. Like that, Samaveda priests entertain the demigods by taking the same Rig Veda mantras and putting them to musical form. That's a Samaveda. And then the Atharva Veda is various magical incantations for dealing with obstacles. If something goes wrong in the sacrifice, then the Atharva Veda priest doesn't say very much. He's just sitting and checking to make sure nothing goes wrong. As soon as something happens that's not supposed to happen, then he starts chanting his Atharva Veda mantras to make up for the mistake. If somebody gets sick, there's different mantras for curing diseases. If some rakshasa comes to disturb the sacrifice, then the Atharva Veda priest has mantras to get rid of the demon, and so on. These are all so different. Anyway, different uses of language. This is the purpose of the four different Vedas. In each Veda, there are four different divisions of text. Every Veda has the original mantras, the original prayers, each of the four Vedas. Those are called the Samhitas. In addition, there are books in each Veda that explain ritualistically the meaning of those mantras. Those are called Brahmanas. Okay? But those are ritualistic explanations. And ordinary Brahmins, household Brahmins who are living in the villages and just performing sacrifices for material purposes, they're satisfied to study the Brahmanas and understanding the ritualistic meaning. But there are others, especially the renunciants who go to the forest, they want to know the more esoteric meaning, the more spiritual meaning. So for them, there are higher explanations in the books called the Aranyakas. So each Veda has these different books. The sannyasis who go to live in the forest, vanaprastha sannyasis, they study the Aranyakas to get the more, inner meanings of the Vedic mantras. And part of the Aranyakas, included in the Aranyakas, are special books called the Upanishads, which contain the real deep philosophy. And ultimately, the explanation of Brahman, the absolute truth, is given in the Upanishads. Upanishads have another name, Vedanta. The Vedanta Sutra is simply a book that Vyasadeva himself wrote, not Shruti, it's not eternal. The Vedanta Sutra is Vyasadeva's personal composition. The Vedanta Sutra is Vyasadeva's explanation, commentary on the Vedanta, on the Upanishads, on the philosophical portion of the Vedas. Okay, anyway, those are the four books that make up each Veda, four different kinds of books. Each Veda has its own. There's Rig Veda Samhita, and Rig Veda Brahmana, Rig Veda Aranyaka, and there's different Upanishads belonging to the Rig Veda, and the same with the other three Vedas. And beside that, there are different versions of each of the four Vedas. Different schools of Brahmins that live in different parts of India that have different versions of each of the four Vedas. There's four versions of the Rig Veda, I think 12 versions of the Yajurveda, 1,000 versions of the Samaveda, and they're all slightly different. Because the Vedas are they're not limited. The same mantras can exist in different versions, and so therefore all these different schools or branches of the Vedas evolve. In particular, the Ayurveda has two basic divisions. The branches of the Ayurveda split up into two groups, the black Ayurveda and the white Ayurveda. I'm mentioning this because we're going to have some quotations from the different Ayurvedas. So black Ayurveda means not that they're worse than the white ones, but normally you have separate books. Books with the mantras and then other books with the explanations, the brahmanas. Black Ayurveda is special in that in the one book, mantras and brahmanas are mixed up together in the same book. You know, you get a few mantras and then some explanation and back to another couple of mantras, back and forth. It's mixed up, and therefore it's called the black Ayurveda. And there's another version of the Ayurveda where the books are kept separate, where the brahmanas, the explanations are all in separate books. So, like for black Ayurveda, it's Taittiriya Samhita. You know, like, we're Vaishnavas, but we say that we're Vedic. So some Vedic Brahman may ask us, hey, what Veda are you connected to? If you claim to be Vedic, you have to be connected to some specific school. So our answer is, we Vaishnavas are connected to the Taittiriya Samhita, the black Ayurveda. You know, that's traditional understanding. Especially since the Taittiriya Upanishad and the Mahanarayana Upanishad are very, very Vaishnav in character. So the Vaishnavas identify with, we consider ourselves belonging to this school. That's one of the major schools of the black Ayurveda. Anyway, there's the Vedas. We're going to look at some interesting statements from the right out of the Vedas about Brahmins and Kshatriyas. And then, that's all Shruti. Besides Shruti, there's also books. Those are books that nobody wrote. Other books that different sages wrote according to their personal understanding, and therefore it's not that the words are eternal. Those are called smritis. So in the original class of the earlier smritis, there's one class, corollaries of the Vedas, secondary sciences, like astrology and grammar, and one of those six sciences is called Kalpa, which means the science of how to perform the sacrifice, ritualistic details. So there are books, the original books in that category, written by various rishis, sages, are the Kalpa Sutras, textbooks on how to perform a sacrifice. And then there's three divisions of the Kalpa Sutras, three different kinds of books in that category. Shrauta Sutras, Griha Sutras, and Dharma Sutras. The Shrauta Sutras explain how to perform the big sacrifices, the public sacrifices, like Soma sacrifice that involves 16, 17 priests. So the big Vedic sacrifices are explained. How to actually do them is explained in the Shrauta Sutras. And various rishis give their different opinions how to go about performing a sacrifice. Then there are other sacrifices that are not so important, not so big, that you perform at home. Like samskaras and the daily sacrifice that every Brahmin has to perform. These are home sacrifices. You know, these are in the Griha Sutras. And then the third category of the ritualistic Kalpa Sutras is the Dharma Sutras. And there, the special topic is how human society is organized. Here's where you find your information on Varnashram, in the Dharma Sutras. How the different classes of people, in the different Varnas and Ashrams, how they're supposed to behave. What's the rules of conduct? Dharma Sutras, these are the early books by ancient sages. And they're written in prose, in short sutras. Later on, other sages took the same information and rewrote them in verse form. And these are what we call the smritis, or the Dharma Shastras. Like the Manusmriti, Manusamhita, is one of these Dharma Shastras. They're almost the same in content as the original Dharma Sutras, but the Dharma Shastras are written in shlokas, in verse. And there are maybe 55 or 60 existing different Dharma Shastras beside Manusamhita. And then there's one last class of literature, Artha Shastra, that's connected with the Dharma Shastra. We know, you know, Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. These are the four goals of human endeavor. religious behavior, economic development, sense gratification and liberation.
So the Dharma Shastras focus on, Dharma Shastras and Artha Shastras both talk basically about the same thing, about how to organize human society, but from two different viewpoints. The Dharma Shastras were written by rishis, by sages, especially to be studied by Brahmins. The Brahmin's concern is how to maintain Dharma, religious, spiritual law and order in human society. So the motive of the Brahmins who were studying and teaching the Dharma Shastras is how to establish and maintain the principles of Dharma and get everybody involved, all the different classes of men. The Artha Shastras explain basically the same topics, but especially for kings, for kshatriyas. A Brahmin wants to study Dharma to understand how to elevate human society, how to benefit everybody. A king studies the same topic to learn how to gain control over the earth. So the Artha Shastras, they're written for kings who want simply to gain power and maintain it. So the same information, but presented in a very much more, with a different motivation. Like Chanaka Pandit, we know. His name is Kautilya, his original name. He wrote the Kautilya Artha Shastra, which contains much of the same information that's in the Manu Samhita, but it's very popular with kings who want to know, get down to brass tacks and find out how to gain power and control people. So, we were talking yesterday about how Kardama Muni, in his prayers, yeah, at this point we can take some questions on what I said about all this. Yeah. Some questions? Yes. Okay. Yeah. The Kalpa is one of the six Vedangas, one of the six Vedic sciences. And the topic of Kalpa is how to perform a sacrifice. In the Vedas, you just got a collection of mantras and some, unorganized explanations of them. But how do you actually put it all together to make a sacrifice? That's explained in the Kalpa literature. And it's smithy, because it's written by various sages. It's not eternal. It actually has human authors. And the original, the earliest ones are the Kalpa Sutras. And then later there were and there are three kinds of Kalpa Sutras. The explanations of how to do a Vedic sacrifice, explanation of how to do a home sacrifice, and then explanation of the laws for organizing human society. Yeah.
One of the Veda unit in the beginning.
What's this?
The Veda unit? One?
One, yes.
Yeah.
I just didn't think I had enough time to discuss that, but I'll briefly. The Vedas originally are one. Vyasadeva at the end of each, there's a different Vyasadeva at the end of each Dwapara Yuga. And he takes the one Veda and divides it into four. Now, what does that mean? There are four different Vedas. There are four different kinds of mantras, and they don't just merge into one another. There are four different kinds of language, and there are four different kinds of priests that study each of those four Vedas. But the mantras are just out there in the ether, and various sages receive various mantras. It's all piecemeal, mixed up. So Vyasadeva sorted it out into separate books and taught the different books to different disciples. He organized it all. He edited. Vyasadeva edited.
Treasury, he has a lot of jewels, but they're in a mess, all mixed up. So he hires a reliable man to come in and put all the diamonds in one pile, all the rubies in another, all the sapphires in another, and the pearls in the fourth pile. That's like Vyasadeva, who came in and sorted out the four kinds of mantras. They're already separate, they're different, but he separated them out into different books. He edited them. That's what it means. Then he made one Veda into four.
They're different. They're different kinds of mantras with different purposes. But they were all mixed up. They were thrown together into one pile.
That doesn't mean the pearl is a ruby. Pearl and a ruby are already separate. But if you mix them up, they're all over the place. They were mixed up, that's all. Because it's also said that Brahma created at the beginning of creation four separate Vedas out of his four different mouths. So they were different even at the beginning of creation. And we're talking about Vyasadeva in Dwarpa Yuga, much after the beginning of creation, separating them. But they were originally separate when they first came out of Brahma's mouth. But they got mixed up. They came out of his mouth, just like if you have sound vibration coming out of four loudspeakers, different tape, you know, you've got four different tape recorders blasting. Once it gets into the ether, the sound waves get all mixed up, and you just get cacophony. You know, the sound waves don't stay separated. You know, the sound waves bounce into each other, and they just get mixed up. But originally, they're separate.
Why
because Samaveda is considered the most devotional. Devotional. Yeah. The Vedas, at least when you look on the surface, they seem to be just dealing with materialistic purposes, ritualistic purposes. Most of the Vedas seems to be just karmakanda. You know, praying to different demigods to get various material benefits. If you look under the surface, you'll discover real devotional purpose of the Vedas, but that's sort of covered and hidden. But the devotional essence of the Vedas is closest to the surface, it's easiest to see in the Samaveda. It's like song, music, more than any other kind of expression, is very emotional, evokes emotion. So like that, the Samaveda very directly evokes devotional sentiment. Anyway, that's Krishna's choice. He said, I'm the shark among fish. It's just, you know, the shark is the biggest and most powerful fish, so therefore Krishna identifies himself with it. And he also, out of the four Vedas, he identifies himself with the Samaveda. Yeah.
Just a clarification for what's written on the board. The Sahitas, Brahmanas, Aranyakas, and Upanishads, is it that each Veda, the Vedas, are some sort of
yes.
They're each divided into which you look at
it? Yes. They each have, they each got their own Samhita, their own Brahmanas, their own Aranyakas, and their own Upanishads. Not only that, but each Veda comes in different versions. There are different branches of each of the four Vedas. And each branch has got its own books in each of those four categories. There's a Taittiriya Samhita of the Black Yajur Veda, Taittiriya Brahmana, Taittiriya Aranyaka, and the Taittiriya Upanishad. And every other branch of every other Veda has got its own complete set of all four books. Not only that, there's more than one Upanishad for each Veda. Hundreds, this is 108 or more Upanishads altogether.
And how many of the total original Samhitas, Brahmanas are remaining?
Remaining? A few hundred. You know, there should be theoretically thousands of them, 5,000 or more. And actually we have less than 500 existing. That's natural. In Kali Yuga, only a small fraction of the Vedic literature is available in Kali Yuga.
5-10%?
Between 5-10% is still available. Yeah.
And the rest of the we just know that they exist.
Theoretically, but they're lost in Kali Yuga. I mean, we can see historically how they're dying out. Nowadays, you're lucky if you can find 20 or 30 Brahmins who properly know how to chant the Samaveda, still left it anywhere in India. So if there's only a handful of people who can chant Samaveda at all, that means most of the a thousand branches of the Samaveda have been lost. There's only a few left that are on the verge of going out of existence. Okay. Oh, yes.
Different sampradayas can claim different sources. What do you mean by that?
Different Vaishnava sampradayas?
Yes.
Yes.
I've read a number of claim the source of Lord Shiva?
A source of the Vedas?
Yeah.
Well, normally, according to the Puranas, and even the Purusha Sutta, says that the Vedas emanate from the mouths of Brahma. And then the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it says that all the Vedas, etad mahabhuta shanishwasatam yad vigvedo yajur veda atara vangrita sa, that the four Vedas and the other Vedic literatures originally are the emanation of the breathing of the Supreme Person. So originally, according to the Upanishads themselves, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's the breath of Narayan from which the Vedas emanate. You can also say when Brahma creates the universe, the Vedas come out of his mouth. But that's not the original origin of the Vedas. That's just in the creation. And then Lord Shiva also, he's speaking Vedas. But actually, what he's mostly speaking is the tantras. You know, he's sitting with his wife, Parvati, and they're discussing tantras. But he's also expert on Vedas. So you can say the Vedas come from Lord Shiva, but it's not the first origin. Yeah. Okay, let's go. Yeah. Hey, one more question. Yeah. Go ahead.
Technically, all these Vedas, the Shruti, you can only pronounce them and study them if you're part of the Brahman system.
Yeah, you have to have Upanayanam. Yeah. Yeah, Vaishyas and Kshatriyas and Vaishyas can take Upanayanam and also chant.
How would you organize that?
Well, the Vaishnav opinion is that someone who becomes a Vaishnav is qualified to perform Vedic sacrifice. Therefore, we do yagyas and we chant Vedic mantras, even though we're most of us are mleches, not born as Brahmins. But if you take Vaishnav diksha, then you're also qualified to chant Vedic mantras. Of course, we're giving out these books to people who don't have initiation. But the idea is, if they study it with the Vaishnav commentary, especially Srila Prabhupada's purport, then ordinary people will become Vaishnavs. And therefore, they'll become qualified to hear even the Vedic mantras. Anyway, the safeguard is that the Isha Upanishad is being presented with the Vaishnav commentary. And therefore, it's accessible. I mean, you could argue. I mean, even Baladeva Vibhushan agrees in the Govinda Bhashyam and the Vedanta that a Shudra should not be allowed to hear the Vedic mantras. And he quotes in the Govinda Bhashyam, a Shudra who's caught, you know, listening in on the sacrifice, you should pour lead in his ears. Yeah. So, but the thing is, who's a Shudra? Yeah. A Shudra is a materialistic person who's inclined to lamentation. You know, a person who's addicted to sense gratification. If someone becomes a Vaishnava, he should never be considered a Shudra, no matter what his birth is. It's not distinguished by birth, it's distinguished by character. So if someone has saintly character, he should be allowed to study and even chant the sacrifice, even perform the Soma sacrifice, if he's a Vaishnava. We take the risk in preaching. It's like Ramanujacharya was ordered by his guru, I'm giving you this Vishnu mantra, don't tell it to anybody. You know, or you'll go to hell. And he immediately climbed on the Gopuram, Kanchipuram, at the temple, and announced to all the people, here's the mantra. In direct violation of his guru's order. And he said, I don't care, I'll go to hell. You know, I have to share this mercy. So like that, you know, even though Krishna says, don't reveal this knowledge to the faithless, the Prabhupada is being more merciful than Krishna by distributing Bhagavad Gita to the faithless and Isha Upanishad. Okay, we'll go to hell. You know, it's in violation of the orders, we'll go to hell. But we have to distribute this knowledge anyway. Okay. Anyway, I wanted to read one of these quotes. I was just giving this outline as a background. And so we were talking about Kardama Muni, how in his prayers he's exhibiting What are the qualities of a Brahman? Honesty, humility. So a Brahman, he minimizes material entanglement. He tries to live a simple life. And he looks to the absolute truth. He tries to dedicate his life to the absolute truth. So there's a nice discussion, brief passage, in the Shatapatha Brahmana, describing how a Brahman acquires good qualities and the influence he has on the rest of human society, the good influence he has because of the qualities he develops. So, this is the Shatapatha Brahmana is connected to the white Yajurveda, the other Yajurveda, not the one that we belong to. The Yajurveda where the mantras and the explanations are not mixed up, they're in separate books. And there is one branch of the Yajurveda, the most prominent, called the Vajrasayani, white Yajurveda, Shukla Yajurveda. You can read about the revelation of that Vajrasayani Samhita in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam. Yajnavalkya, he was studying with his guru, and he got a little proud and said, what about these other disciples? They're not smart. I'm better than the rest of them. And his guru got angry at him and said, what are you so puffed up about? You know, I reject you. You should immediately regurgitate all the mantras I taught you. And so he did. He threw up all the mantras. And the other disciples were greedy to get the mantras, so they all took the form of pigeons, partridges, little birds, and they ate the vomit to get the mantras. And they were, Taittiriya is the word in Sanskrit, so that's the Taittiriya Samhita. That's the Taittiriya Samhita, the black Yajurveda. But after that, now he's lost all his mantras. Yajnavalkya went, having been rejected by his guru, he went to worship the sun god and prayed, give me some other mantras that nobody has. I want some new mantras that have never been revealed from the Yajurveda. And so the sun god responded to his prayers, and the revelation of this white Yajurveda, Vajrasayani Samhita, was given to Yajnavalkya. So in the that white Vajrasayani version of the white Yajurveda has a brahmana called the Shatapatha Brahmana, 100 paths, very elaborate ritual explanation. Some interesting things in there about Brahmins and Kshatriyas. So one passage from Shatapatha Brahmana, chapter 9, section number 5. I'll read the Sanskrit English, and then maybe tomorrow the day after I'll pass out a sheet, so you don't have to worry about trying to write it down and memorize it. Sanskrit. Pragya Vardamana Chaturo Dharman Brahmanam Abhinishpadayati Brahmanyam Pratirupacharyam Yasho Loka Paktim Loka Pachamanas Chaturbir Dharmai Brahmanam Banakti Archaya Chadanina Chadyayataya Chavadyatayacha. Okay, translation. This is my attempt to translate it. When a Brahman's intelligence becomes sharp, it equips him with four essential qualities, and they are purity of descent, befitting conduct, reputation, and elevation of the people to maturity by his teachings. And it goes on and says, when the people become elevated to maturity, they reciprocate. So maybe I'll explain that a little bit. Purity of descent. So Brahman, when he performs discipline and austerity, and his intelligence becomes elevated, then he develops the brahminical qualities. Purity of descent. Of course, in his previous life, he practices sadhana, and then he takes a good birth. So, although we have preached that birth is not essential, but still, if you're born in a good Brahmin family, that's a great advantage.
So many great Brahmins were born in Brahmin families. We're living in a mixed up world. So, you know, we're picking Brahmins out of the gutter. But the normal system is you're born in a proper Brahmin family and you get a good background and training. So someone who for many lifetimes practices to be a Brahmin, he'll take a good Brahmin birth. That's the first quality you earn by your sadhana, to practice to be a Brahmin. Second, befitting conduct. Krishna says, Chaturvarna maya shrishtam guna karma vibhavishan. The four divisions of society, varnas, are distinguished by guna and karma, not primarily birth. Birth is secondary. Primary distinction, criterion of who's a Brahmin, distinguished by guna and karma, not primarily birth. Birth is secondary. Primary distinction, criterion of who's a Brahmin, who's a Shudra, is what's their character and how do they behave. Now you can have a Brahminical character, you can be smart and be religiously inclined, but if your training is not good and your habits aren't good, then you're not really a Brahmin. You're not a Brahmin by birth, even if you've got the potential. You have to be trained up and you have to live up to the standard. You have to take advantage of your training to become a real Brahmin. But one who performs the proper sadhana, maybe in many lifetimes, he also comes to that standard of proper behavior. And what's proper behavior for a Brahmin? The standards are very strict. You know, he has to, just like we have our four regular principles. That's minimum. You know, in the Dharma Shastra, there's hundreds of regular principles. You know, enough to make your head spin. And the Brahmins are meant to obey all these rules and regulations. They behave very properly. Krishna says in the Gita, Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te, Karya Karya Vivastitao, Tasmat Shastram Vadan Uktam, Karma Kartam Arhasi. You know, you should be a Paka Brahman, Arjuna. You should do everything you do on the basis of the Shastric injunctions. Before you decide to do anything or not to do anything, what to do and what not to do, you consult the Shastra and don't do anything whimsically. That's Brahminical behavior. You think, what does the Shastra want me to do or not do before you do anything? That's proper behavior. And then reputation. So what's the Brahmin's reputation based on? A king's reputation is based on what he's conquered and how he controls and his charisma. You know, or he gives out lots of charity and everybody loves him for that. But a Brahmin is not, doesn't get a reputation for how much money he spends or how he controls people. His reputation is the trustworthiness of his word. A Brahmin is respected and he's influential because people trust what he says. They believe what he says. They know this person only speaks the truth and he knows what he's talking about. That's the reputation of a Brahmin. And that's much more important than the reputation of a Kshatriya. That's the basis of Vedic society. When you have people whose word can be trusted, then you can have a peaceful, progressive society. Without that, everything's chaos. So the reputation of the Brahmins, based on the trustworthiness of what they say, is the most important foundation of the whole Vedic social system. And traditionally, when you grow up in that system, you trust the Brahmins because they supported you and gave you guidance from your very birth. You know, your Brahmins taught your mother and father how to conceive you, how to have you as a child, how to raise you. And then the Brahmins taught you from the first day in school, you know, up to the day you died, the Brahmins guided you and taught you how to live your life properly. Therefore you trust them. Not just because it says so in some book, or somebody says you gotta, you know, obey the Brahmins or they'll curse you. No, because they actually took care of you your whole life, and therefore you trust them. Therefore, to establish a system is not an overnight thing. You have to establish the trust over generations. That's a reputation. That's the second important quality that one who becomes a Brahmin acquires, is influence by the purity and trustworthiness of his word. An elevation of the pure, that was the third one, purity of descent, befitting conduct. Third was reputation. Fourth was elevation of people to maturity by his teaching. He has knowledge, he doesn't keep it to himself. He uses it to benefit the rest of society. Like we said yesterday, what distinguishes the Brahmins and Kshatriyas from the two lower classes is that they're selfless servants of the rest of society. They're not selfish. They're working to benefit everybody. So they have knowledge and they teach that knowledge in order to elevate everybody. And because their word is trusted and they have something, they know what they're talking about, therefore they actually can accomplish that. They can raise the consciousness and the behavior of the whole society. Okay, then when people get that benefit of Brahminical guidance, they reciprocate. They treat the Brahmins with respect. And the four qualities of respect they show: worship, Brahmin should be honored. He shouldn't be treated like an ordinary person. He should be he should be offered charity. He should just support the Brahmins. They shouldn't have to work for a living. They shouldn't have to hustle to survive. In a society that's at all civilized, the proper Brahmins are maintained by charity. They don't even have to ask for it. When that's lacking, how can the Brahmins function as Brahmins? Nobody's going to give them charity. They have to go out and work like everybody else. How can they act like Brahmins then? So it's necessary that the social system be established to give support for the prosecution of spiritual life. And then in relationship to the government, immunity from domination. That means the king is ruling everybody, but he doesn't try to rule the Brahmins. He gives the Brahmins their autonomy and leaves them alone as much as possible. Now, the Brahmins, they know how to live their own life. They don't have to be dominated by the government. And certainly, the last thing is immunity from capital punishment. You don't kill a Brahmin. Ashwatthama committed a heinous crime. It was wartime, but he shouldn't have had to done that. He shouldn't have murdered these children of the Pandavas in their sleep. Even Duryodhan thought it was disgusting. And Krishna told Arjuna captured Ashwatthama. Because after that, Ashwatthama tried to kill the Pandavas, and then using his Brahmastra weapon, he did not know how to withdraw. He tried to kill the Pandavas and Uttara with Parikshit, the last Pandava, the last Kuru heir, in her womb, not even born. Not enough that he killed these children, he had to kill the unborn child in the womb of Uttara also. So they caught him before, they stopped him from doing this. Krishna stopped him. And Arjuna captured Ashwatthama, and Krishna told him, kill him without any consideration. Kill him immediately for what he's done. Unacceptable, intolerable what he did. But still, Arjuna said, okay, well, let's bring him to the camp. I promised Draupadi that she could take her bath after mourning her son standing on his head. So I had to bring him to Draupadi first. So Krishna, even though Arjuna told him to kill, he brought Ashwatthama back to the camp, and Draupadi didn't want to kill him. He said, look, this is the son of our guru. Now, I don't want Kripi, Ashwatthama, Dronacharya's wife, widow, to be lamenting like I'm lamenting now for my children. So don't kill him. He's a Brahmin. The Brahmin is always worshipable. Even if they, no matter what they've done, you don't kill a Brahmin. So Krishna said, and then Bhima, he said, no, kill him. Bhima came in. So everybody gives a different opinion. And then Krishna wanted to show how intelligent Arjuna is. Okay, Arjuna, you have to satisfy all of us. I said kill, Bhima said kill, Draupadi said don't kill. Yudhishthira, he's just going along with Draupadi. You satisfy everybody and also satisfy the Vedic injunctions. Do the right thing. You figure out what to do. So Arjuna thought for 1 minute And he took his sword and he cut the jewel off the head of Ashwatthama. He was born with a jewel on his head. And cut half of his hair off and kicked him out of the camp. Disrespectfully, as some dog. And that was right, that he made the right choice. This is the appropriate capital punishment for a member of a Brahmin family. You don't kill him physically, but by depriving him of his wealth and shamefully, cutting off his hair and exiling him, that's the proper punishment for a Brahmin who otherwise would have to be killed. You don't kill a Brahmin. So the Brahmins are exempt from capital punishment, no matter what they do, if they're proper Brahmins. Okay, any comments? Here? Yes.
Brahmin engaged in
battle. You know, sir? Normally not, but in emergency situations they can. A Brahmin should simply do his rabbinical work. Worship, sacrifice, teach, give charity and accept charity. But if they can't maintain themselves just by that, then in emergencies they can do the work of a kshatriya, which normally means become a landlord. But they could even fight if they have to. Now, at the end of Dwarpa Yuga, the situation of the world was very abnormal. The whole world was out of balance. Too many powerful kings. Atheism was prominent. The mode of passion was way out of control. And so you have unusual things happening, like Brahmins being born with kshatriya qualities, like Dronacharya. He's born in a sage's family, but he really, from his birth, he was attracted to military science. That's just his nature. So he became a great expert in military. He was a Brahmin, but he became a warrior. It's unusual, but in exceptional circumstances it's possible. A Brahmin can do the work of a kshatriya in unusual circumstances. Other way? Well, kshatriyas share some of the activities of the Brahmin. They also study the Vedas. They also perform sacrifices. But a kshatriya should not accept charity. The Brahmins can do that. And they shouldn't be teachers of the Vedas. They study the Vedas, but they're not the teachers. So there's some overlapping, but there's still, things that only Brahmins do.
Why did you want to be teachers of the Vedas?
Because teaching is the privileged function of the Brahmins.
They can
give instruction. Yeah, just like King Janaka, engaged in debate with great rishis. Yeah, but they don't become the gurus. Yeah, they don't become, that's not their occupation. They can engage in philosophical discussion, but they're not the official teachers. Yes, that's in the Dharma Shastras, yes. Out of the six, there are three that they have to do. Which are?
But the teaching is that it's not composed of the three. It's actually in the
Vedas. Well, in the university, in a graduate department, there may be 150 graduate students. How many of them are going to become professors? Maybe five out of 150. So not every good student is qualified to be a first-class teacher. So therefore, not all Brahmins become teachers. Some of them are just mediocre. Yeah, they can do some sacrifices and a little bit of, but they're not up to the standard of being a big teacher. Some Brahmins are teachers, and not all of them. Some of them are just, Pujaris or something. Yes?
So you were saying that the first compulsion is to be charity.
Yeah, you don't have to take charity. They can just distribute to everybody. All the other classes are below them, so they can give to everybody. But the highest charity is to give knowledge. To teach is the highest act of charity. That's first class charity. give money is second rate. But a Brahmin shouldn't keep more than he can use immediately. If he gets excess, he shouldn't put it in the bank. It says that a first-class Brahmin doesn't keep more than he can use in one day. Doesn't keep food in the refrigerator or anything. So if he has an excess, he has to give it away immediately. To somebody, to anybody. Well, you know, another first-class Brahmin is the best choice, but at least get rid of it somehow. Go ahead. No, the best charity is for qualified Brahmins. But just like if you're distributing prasadam, we're not going to give prasadam only to the Brahmins. We'll give prasadam to everybody, even the cats and dogs. So there's certain kinds of charity that's appropriate to give to everybody, especially distribution of prasadam to everybody. And basic knowledge we should give to everybody. We give the Mahamantra to everybody. Esoteric, you know, the confidential information about, you know, the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. We don't give that to everybody. We give that to qualified people. But there's certain things we give to everybody. Yes, ma'am.
Is this the three of the elements of Vidya and Brahma are by which he maintains his livelihood in the three compulsory?
Yes. Yes. The three compulsory activities, those are his basic duties. The other three are the ways that he keeps himself, keeps his family fed. But it's also, the other three are also his contribution to society. Okay. We've got a few minutes. I wanted to go back to Kardama Muni. He's pretty, I'll finish up his prayers, or at least make an attempt at it. Let's look at text 17. Well, in the rest of his prayers, he's sort of shifting. He was talking about himself as a material, you know, sort of trying to present himself as a materialist in the first few verses. You know, people who come to you, O Lord, with material desires, they're real fools, and I'm one of those fools. But he sort of contradicts himself in the rest of his prayers. He reveals his actual very deep Krishna conscious understanding. You know, he's not the materialist he pretends to be. He actually is quite a Vaishnav. And we'll see that in these five verses of the rest of his prayers. So therefore, what we see in these prayers is not so much the quality of a Brahmin, but on a different level, the quality of a Vaishnav. Text 17. Lokams cha lokanugatam pashums cha hidvashvitaste charanatapatram parasparam twad gunavaru sidhu piyusha niryapita deha dharmaha. However, he was just talking about foolish people, you know, who go to you for material benefits. And then he says, on the other hand, however, persons who have given up stereotyped worldly affairs and the beastly followers of those affairs, and who have taken shelter of the umbrella of your lotus feet by drinking the intoxicating nectar of your qualities and activities in discussions with one another, can be freed from the primary necessities of this material body. What are you talking about here? He's talking about Harinam Sankirtan. Yeah. Not only the, you know, shifting to the topic of, or, you know, revelation of his understanding of devotional service, he's jumping right to the essential, most intimate aspect of devotional service. The hearing and chanting of the glories of the personality of Godhead in the association of pure devotees. That is Sankirtan. Yes, I'm sorry? Krishna Katha, yes. But especially Krishna Katha together with other devotees. That's Kirtan, but that's Sankirtan. Congregational chanting. So, he's discussing here, Kardava, how One becomes free from all these bodily necessities by taking shelter of the Supreme Person's lotus feet by devotional service. We have our embarrassing situation. We're in this world with material desires. But if we take shelter of the Lord, especially by performance of devotional service, and especially by Shravanam Kirtanam, by that form of devotional service, we'll become free from all this embarrassing entanglement. By drinking the nectar, piyusha. Piyusha means liquor. Intoxicating beverage. Of topics, discussions of your qualities, your transcendental spiritual qualities, we'll forget material intoxication by a higher intoxication. Like Narottam Das Thakur phrase, Vishaya Vashana Mur Kobe Tucho Hobe. By remembering the glories of Radha and Krishna, the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, their senses and minds are still active. They're not, impersonalists who are trying to shut down their senses. They're engaging their senses very actively in devotional service. But because their senses are filled with the glories of Radha and Krishna, their material urges, even though they're still there, become insignificant. You don't even notice that your senses are making so many demands in your mind. You can't, you have no time to pay attention to them. So, tuchohobe, the urges of the senses and the mind become insignificant. That's the state of advanced devotional service, absorption in Harikatha. Give up lokan and lok anugatan pashun. Give up this material world and all its foolishness, and especially the animalistic people who populate this world. Not to insult anybody, but from the transcendental point of view, most of the people in this world are living like animals. And therefore, why indulge in the association of animals unless you want to be an animal? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he was talking to Raghunath Das, when Raghunath Das managed finally to escape from his parents, and his parents, what was his name? Hiranya Majumda? Govardhan Majumda was his uncle? Very prominent Vaishnavas of Bengal, zamindars, rich landowners, but also very famous as very religious Vaishnavas. Haridas Thakur visited them. And was agreed to speak in their assembly. So they were reputable Vaishnavas. And if Haridas Thakur comes to your house, you must be a decent person. But Lord Chaitanya said, you know what I really think of your father and uncle? I think you're like worms in a stool, in a cesspool. Nice. And he said, that's fine, because they're just, they think they have the reputation of Vaishnavas, but they're addicted to sense gratification. So from the transcendental point of view, most of the people in this world are two-legged animals. So that's what Kadam is saying. Give up this world and all the animals that populate it. So Kadam himself admitted that he has the desire to get married, to get a wife. These are just bodily needs. If you have such bodily desires, you have to follow the Vedic regulations if you want to remain a civilized person. If you can't give up material desires but you want to be a civilized person, you have to follow the Vedas. If you become a pure devotee, then you can ignore the Vedic regulations. But first of all, you have to become fully Krishna conscious. Otherwise, if you still have material desires, you're going to have to follow the rules and regulations of the social system. Tavat karma Krishna, we quoted this yesterday, Krishna says to Uddhava, Tavat karmani kurivita namir vidyeta yavata mat katashvava nadalva yavat shvatana jayate. You have to continue doing your Vedic duty, varnashram duty, until you actually give up your interest in it. Okay, when you have no more desire for material things, okay, then you can forget the rules and regulations of the Varnashram system. When you're free completely from material desire. Or in other words, what that also means, until you become very attracted to hearing and chanting my glories, means the same thing. Giving up material desires means it's only accomplished by becoming attracted to Hari Katha. In the purport, Prabhupada talks about, he uses the phrase, stereotyped worldly affairs. Let me find that here. Anyway, didn't have enough time. Second line, yeah. Part of Mamuni asserts that marriage and other social affairs are stereotyped regulations for persons who are addicted to material sense enjoyment. Prabhupada uses very interesting language. Prabhupada studied English in the old school, Scottish Church College in Calcutta. He studied English literature from the 19th century and older English literature. So he uses language that we're not familiar with, but very, very graphic language. Stereotype means hackneyed, you know, overused. You know, people just do the same thing over and over again. 10 million lifetimes after another, you pursue sense gratification. The same old sense gratification, different forms. You know, you can drink your milk out of a clay cup or a gold cup, but it's the same thing you're drinking. Same sense gratification, life after life. Stereotype, same thing over and over again. That's material life. But what's this word stereotype? What's the history of it? Anybody know what the word actually means? A stereotype? Yeah, but it has a history. Okay, back in the 19th century, when they first were printing books, go back to the 16th, 15th century, the invention was, the language has 50 letters, 48 letters. The English language has only 26 letters in the English language. So instead of carve out the whole page of the Bible, make a carving, of the whole book and print that, why don't you just make 26 different letters and stick them together and make a page like that? Then you just have to have a lot of little letters and pick them out and make a page. So for 300 or 400 years, that's how they printed books. They'd have a box with hundreds and thousands of different little letters, and the little boy would pick them out and assemble the page. But then they figured, well, look, we have to do this over and over again. Somebody invented what was called a stereotype. You take a page made up of all these little letters, and you put paper mache over it, and you make an impression like a mold, and you use that paper mache mold to make another mold made out of metal, which has the shape of all the letters in one piece. Not all these little pieces, but one piece, and that's permanent. That's called a stereotype. Now, stereo means three-dimensional. So it's a three-dimensional mold built on top of the original box of little letters. That's the invention. Somebody invented it and called it a stereotype. So a stereotype is something you use to make an impression of the same thing over and over and over again. And so therefore the idea of the word became something that's just overused. Anyway, a lot of the phrases Prabhupada uses have these quaint histories. But, okay, that's verse 17. Let's look at verse 18.
Nate jaraksha bhamir ayuresham trishodasharam trishatam shashti parva shanni mananta chariyat trinabi karala sroto jagat achidya dhava.
Okay, this is an esoteric verse. Your wheel, which has three knaves. Knaves are, wheel has a center like this, what do you call it? Anyway, the spokes coming out and the outside of the wheel. The knaves are the three parts of that inner circle. Those are knaves. Am I right? Okay. rotates around the axis, of the wheel, making the two wheels, of the imperishable Brahman. It has 13 spokes, 360 joints going around the wheel, six rims, so a rim and then another rim and six of them, and numberless leaves carved upon it, just decorations. Through its revolution, though its revolution cuts short the lifespan of the entire creation, this wheel of tremendous velocity cannot touch the lifespan of the devotees of the Lord. This is just a symbolic description of time. Time cannot touch the lifespan of the devotees of the Lord. Because their bodies die, but they gain eternal life. Those who practice pure devotional service. Otherwise, everybody else, their life is cut short by time. And time has various divisions. Three waves, divisions of that inner wheel. Those are the three seasons, the 4 month divisions of the year. Chaturmasya is the rainy season, 4 months, but there's 4 times 3 months in the whole year, 12 months. So there's three chaturmasyas. Those are the basic divisions. And also you can divide the year up into six parts. In India, those are the six seasons. 13 months. Yeah, we count 12 months, but every few years is a leap month, so there's a 13th month also. 360 days, and the minutes or the moments are countless. There's so many you can't even count them. Those are the divisions of time. And this time rotates around Brahman. In other words, time is the energy of the Supreme, the Eternal Supreme. The Supreme is unchanging and eternal. But he controls the material creation by the divisions of time. This is a statement in the second canto, the first canto of the Bhagavatam. Ayur harati vai pumsam ujjan astan chayanasau tasyarte yakshano nito uttamashloka lilaya. The sun is taking away the life span of every person. Every time the sun rises and sets, everybody's a day closer to death. With the exception of those persons who spend all their time in the hearing and chanting of the glories of the Supreme Person. The sun and the sun doesn't take their life away. That's verse 18. Yes, I'm sorry. Six rims. Those are the six seasons. You know, in India, we don't have four seasons, we have six, each 2 months long. It works like that. You know, we're used in the West that everything follows a solar calendar. Winter equinox comes, and it's the longest, shortest day of the year. Cold days in January always. But in India, it works differently. The Santa Panchami, the first day of spring, comes at a different day in the solar calendar every year. This year was January 29th. But it always works out, at least in Braj, that it starts getting warm on the Santa Panchami. And then when Shivaratri comes, then it's really warm. It always follows somehow in India, or at least in the Holy Dham, the lunar calendar actually establishes the seasons. Text 19. No, we're out of time. Let's stop here. Any final comments? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, I mean, a devotee also gets sick and gets old and dies, but he's disconnecting himself from the bodily connection, from the bodily attachments. It doesn't matter to him that his body is going to die, or that all his money is going to be taken away from him, or he has to give up his family. he doesn't even identify with them anymore. So for him, he doesn't lose anything. He, you know, he's gained his treasure in the eternal world, and time can't take that away. That's all. And he's, you know, his body is going to die, but it's not his body anymore. He's already given it up, even before he leaves it. Okay.
And thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.